Monster Man, special episode, Creatures of the Dreamlands. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, Patreon backer Scott. If you'd like to be like Scott and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get the rewards for lower levels. Occasional bonus content, well, it's pretty regular, it's about once a month, bonus content at the $1 level, and at the $2 level, my other show, Patron Deities, which is currently in the middle of a series about Egyptian mythology. So Scott, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Scott has asked me to talk about the Dreamlands. What are the Dreamlands? Well, when we think of H.P. Lovecraft, we think of the Cthulhu mythos and its attendant sort of what's often called Lovecraft Country. So Arkham, Massachusetts, Miskatonic University, all that kind of thing. But that isn't all that Lovecraft wrote, despite the fact that that's what I think most people are familiar with, because that's what the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game is mainly about. Lovecraft also wrote a series of stories set in a kind of fantasy world that was supposed to be the world that people could go to when they dreamt. And this was very heavily inspired by the works of one of Lovecraft's favorite authors, Lord Dunsany. Lovecraft, in fact, sometimes criticized himself for trying to write too much like Dunsany, and also too much like Poe. There are a good number of Dreamland stories. Overall, I would say they probably trend a little earlier in his career. And they do, particularly the story that we're mostly going to be talking about in this episode, they do also overlap with the Cthulhu mythos. So the one that we're going to be discussing, the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, has, you know, some images that tie in with the kind of nihilistic cosmos of Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos. So what makes a Dreamlands monster? A lot of it is in the presentation. One of the things that Lovecraft does with Dreamland monsters is, rather than having like the kind of, you know, a typical, what we would think of as a Lovecraftian horror story, depicts a kind of realistic contemporary locale and then inserts a monster which is sort of a violation of the natural order into it. And in some stories, Lovecraft describes those monsters in great detail. So think about the old ones in At the Mountains of Madness, who are described in kind of clinical scientific detail. And in some cases, he is quite vague. So the unnameable would be the most obvious example, but there are lots of other ones where Lovecraft is more interested in conveying the impressions that these monsters create. But in the Dreamlands, monsters are a little bit more taken for granted, right? Lovecraft is trying to impress on the reader how strange this world is, that the presence of monsters is a comparatively everyday thing. Not totally everyday, but a little bit. And an example of this would be the Zoogs. So all of these readings that I'm going to be doing come from The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. This is in the Penguin Classics edition. And here it discusses the Zoogs. In the tunnels of that twisted wood, whose low, prodigious oaks twine groping boughs and shine dim with the phosphorescence of strange fungi, dwell the furtive and secretive Zoogs, who know many obscure secrets of the dream world and a few of the waking world, since the wood at two places touches the lands of men, though it would be disastrous to say where. Certain unexplained rumors, events, and vanishments occur among men where the Zoogs have access, and it is well that they cannot travel far outside the world of dream. But over the nearer parts of the dream world they pass freely, flitting small and brown and unseen, and bearing back piquant tales to beguile the hours around their hearths in the forest they love. Most of them live in burrows, but some inhabit the trunks of the great trees, and although they live mostly on fungi, it is muttered that they also have a slight taste for meat, either physical or spiritual, for certainly many dreamers have entered that wood who have not come out. Carter, however, had no fear, for he was an old dreamer, and had learnt their fluttering language and made many a treaty with them, having found through their help the splendid city of Celephais in Uthnargai beyond the Tenarian hills, where reigns half the year the great king Kuranes, a man he had known by another name in life. And then later on it says, he traced his way by the grotesque fungi, which always seem better nourished as one approaches the dread circle where elder beings danced and sacrificed. Finally, the greater light of those thicker fungi revealed a sinister green and gray vastness, pushing up through the roof of the forest and out of sight. This was the nearest of the great ring of stones, and Carter knew he was close to the Zoog village. Renewing his fluttering sound, he waited patiently, and was at length rewarded by an impression of many eyes watching him. It was the Zoogs, for one sees their weird eyes long before one can discern their small, slippery brown outlines. Out they swarmed, from a hidden burrow and honeycomb tree, till the whole dim, litten region was alive with them. Some of the wilder ones brushed Carter unpleasantly, and one even nipped loathsomely at his ear, but these lawless spirits were soon restrained by their elders. The Council of Sages, recognizing the visitor, offered a gourd of fermented sap from a haunted tree unlike the others, which had grown from a seed dropped down by someone on the moon. So, Zoogs are all sort of fairy-like creatures, although we do get little touches of Lovecraftianism. And this, sort of the evocative names of Selephais and Uthnaragai and the great King Kuranis, you know, that's the real Dunsanyism. It occurs to me, actually, that we've discussed Lord Dunsany before, because he is the author of How Nuth Would Have Practiced His Art Upon the Gnolls, which is where the name Gnoll comes from, even though the creature, the Gnoll, in D&D has very little to do with the Gnoll in How Nuth Would Have Practiced His Art Upon the Gnolls. And as we can see with the Zoog, in this case, the nature of the monster specifically is a little ambiguous, because Dreamland Monster is all about creating atmosphere. Mind you, that's how I tend to view monsters in general. But although I've read this section about Zoogs, actually Zoogs are not one of the three monsters that I really want to talk about in this episode. I have picked three Dreamland monsters that I think suit a more classic D&D-like role. And we're going to start by talking about Gugs. So a Gug is basically a kind of giant or ogre with weirdly divided forearms and a vertical mouth. They are a hazard that Carter and his entourage of ghouls have to navigate as they go on part of the quest, and they also have to navigate a landscape that is built by and made for Gugs. There's not really a lot of Gug material in the Dream Quest. So the Penguin Classics edition, again, the Gugs take up maybe about 6 pages, but they have proved very memorable. I'll read some of the relevant sections. For the ghouls of the waking world do no business in the graveyards of Upper Dreamland, leaving that to the web-footed womps that are spawned in dead cities. And many things intervene betwixt their gulf and the enchanted wood, including the terrible kingdom of the Gugs. The Gugs, hairy and gigantic, once reared stone circles in that wood and made strange sacrifices to the other gods and the crawling chaos Nyarlathotep, until one night an abomination of theirs reached the ears of Earth's gods and they were banished to caverns below. Only a great trapdoor of stone with an iron ring connects the abyss of the Earth ghouls with the enchanted wood, and this the Gugs are afraid to open because of a curse. That a mortal dreamer could traverse their cavern realm and leave by that door is inconceivable, for mortal dreamers were their former food, and they have legends of the toothsomeness of such dreamers, even though banishment has restricted their diet to the ghasts, those repulsive beings which die in the light and which live in the vaults of Zin and leap on long hind legs like kangaroos. So then, Carter and the ghouls go on their expedition. So at length Carter crawled through endless burrows with 3 helpful ghouls. When they came again into open twilight, they were in a forest of vast lichened monoliths, reaching nearly as high as the eye could see, and forming the modest gravestones of the Gugs. On the right of the hole out of which they wriggled, and seen through aisles of monoliths, was a stupendous vista of cyclopean round towers mounting up illimitable into the grey air of inner earth. This was the great city of the Gugs, whose doorways are 30 feet high. Ghouls come here often, for a buried Gug will feed a community for almost a year, and even with the added peril, it is better to burrow for Gugs than to bother with the graves of men. Carter now understood the occasional Titan bones he had felt beneath him in the Vale of Pnath. Later on, and yet, horrible as they were not so horrible as what presently came out of the cave after them, with disconcerting suddenness. It was a paw, fully 2.5 feet across and equipped with formidable talons. After it came another paw, and after that a great black furred arm, to which both of the paws were attached by short forearms. The 2 pink eyes shone, and the head of the awakened Gug sentry, large as a barrel, wobbled into view. The eyes jutted 2 inches from each side, shaded by bony protuberances overgrown with coarse hairs, but the head was chiefly terrible because of the mouth. That mouth had great yellow fangs and ran from the top to the bottom of the head, opening vertically instead of horizontally. But before that unfortunate Gug could emerge from the cave and rise to his full 20 feet, the vindictive ghasts were upon him. From all sides, the venomous ghasts rushed feverishly at the creeping Gug, nipping and tearing with their muzzles and mauling murderously with their hard, pointed hooves. I mean, and that's pretty much it for the Gugs, but in that short, you know, couple of bits of description, we've got a memorable monster. It's got a powerful visual you know, the vertical mouth, the protruding eyes, the arms, where each upper arm has two forearms. It's got a short backstory, and it's got an environment, the city of the Gugs, the tombs of the Gugs, and we see how other monsters respond to and interact with them, both fearing them, right? The ghouls spend a lot of time trying to avoid a Gug sentry because they don't want to fight a Gug. Those boys mean business. But on the other hand, the ghouls plunder the Gug cemetery because Gugs are so big that they're an excellent source of food for ghouls. History that affects the course of the adventure, check. Conflicts between different monster groups within the dungeon, check. Short-ish, but effective visual description, check. Great dungeon monster. Next up, let's talk about the Moon Beasts. Now, the Moon Beasts are more of a villain monster, unlike the hazard monster of the Gugs. They are described pretty horribly in the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, but the little bits and pieces occur throughout the whole section. So I'll just... So here are some examples of Lovecraft's description of the Moon Beast. It's interesting that he describes both their appearance and their behavior as horrific to Carter. So here, some Moon Beasts are watching ghouls being tortured. There, around a hideous fire fed by the obnoxious stems of lunar fungi, there squatted a stinking circle of the toad-like moon beasts and their almost human slaves. Some of these slaves were heating curious iron spears in the leaping flames, and at intervals applying their white-hot points to three tightly trussed prisoners. From the motions of their tentacles, Carter could see that the blunt-snouted moon beasts were enjoying this spectacle hugely. The number of malodorous moon beasts about that greenish fire was very great, and Carter saw that he could do nothing now to save his former allies. Of how the ghouls had been captured, he could not guess, but fancied that the grey, toad-like blasphemies had heard them inquire in Dilathleen concerning the way to Sarkamand, and had not wished them to approach so closely the hateful plateau of Leng and the High Priest not to be described. And so we actually get a big battle between an army of ghouls and night gaunts and these creatures and their servants. So the Moon Beasts are not really the main antagonist of the story necessarily, but as a threat to Carter and his allies, they help to establish sort of what kind of place the Dreamlands are, that there are these whole cities, whole nations run by these alien sadists and their henchmen, the Men of Leng. Now, because this is Lovecraft, that description of the Men of Leng is not free of certain literary conventions that tie into racist or Orientalist stereotypes. So, but the Moon Beasts, I think, can work separately from that, because the idea of, you know, alien conspiracy masterminds working through a network of human or quasi-human agents, because they know that, you know, they have this monstrous appearance, and if they went out into human society, they'd be spotted, I think can work. Again, it's noticeable that Carter, who is allied again with an army of ghouls and night gaunts, of whom more anon, is repelled by these hideous creatures. Randolph Carter is a guy with a pretty strong stomach, you know, and you know that you're probably the villain of the story when a pack of ghouls think that you're going a bit far. Finally, we come to the Night Gaunt. Now, I presented these monsters in alphabetical order, but even if I hadn't, I would have saved the Night Gaunt for last, because I think, Cthulhu aside, I think the Night Gaunts are actually the Lovecraft monster, because they, in fact, come from H.P. Lovecraft's childhood nightmares, which he later said were inspired by illustrations by Gustave Doré. And Night Gaunts appear both as hostile creatures and as allies. They capture Carter in the Vale of Pnath, or actually they sort of take him to the Vale of Pnath, and that's where we get an introduction to them. Although later on, they wind up being allies because Night Gaunts and ghouls get along. Suddenly, without a warning sound in the dark, Carter felt his curved scimitar drawn stealthily out of his belt by some unseen hand. Then he heard it clatter down over the rocks below, and between him and the Milky Way, he thought he saw a very terrible outline of something noxiously thin and horned and tailed and bat-winged. Other things, too, had begun to blot out patches of stars west of him, as if a flock of vague entities were flapping thickly and silently out of that inaccessible cave in the face of the precipice. Then a sort of cold, rubbery arm seized his neck, and something else seized his feet, and he was lifted inconsiderately up and swung about in space. Another minute, and the stars were gone, and Carter knew that the Night Gaunts had got him. They bore him breathless into that cliffside cavern and through monstrous labyrinths beyond. When he struggled, as at first he did by instinct, they tickled him with deliberation. They made no sound at all themselves, and even their membranous wings were silent. They were frightfully cold and damp and slippery, and their paws needed one detestably. Soon they were plunging hideously downward through inconceivable abysses in a whirling, giddying, sickening rush of dank, tomb-like air, and Carter felt they were shooting into the ultimate vortex of shrieking and demonic madness. He screamed again and again, but whenever he did so, the black paws tickled him with greater subtlety. Then he saw a sort of gray phosphorescence about, and guessed they were coming even to that inner world of subterrane horror of which dim legends tell, and which is lit only by the pale death fire wherewith reeks the ghoulish air and the primal mists of the pits at the earth's core. At last, far below him, he saw faint lines of gray and ominous pinnacles, which he knew must be the fabled peaks of Thok. Awful and sinister they stand in the haunted dusk of sunless and eternal depths, higher than man may reckon, and guarding terrible valleys where the boles crawl and burrow nastily. But Carter preferred to look at them than at his captors, which were indeed shocking and uncouth black things, with smooth, oily, whale-like surfaces, unpleasant horns that curved inward toward each other, bat wings whose beating made no sound, ugly prehensile paws, and barbed tails that lashed needlessly and disquietingly. And worst of all, they never spoke or laughed and never smiled, because they had no faces at all to smile with, but only a suggestive blankness where a face ought to be. All they ever did was clutch and fly and tickle. That was the way of Night Gaunts. Now, Lovecraft has written more about the Night Gaunts elsewhere. There's a poem about it. It includes the line, "Tales that bear the bifid barb of hell." I remember that much off the top of my head, but I don't remember the whole thing. Anyway, these are genuinely creatures that frightened young Lovecraft, that he had nightmares about when he was a kid. And I think that the kind of stamp of childish authenticity on that is the bit where they tickle you, right? That's very weird. The idea that, you know, you're being restrained by the Night Gaunts and then they are tickling you, and I mean, that's deeply creepy and uncomfortable, and I think maybe tough to sell. Like, I think if you have that description in a monster in a game, you do have to worry that it's not going to land. I think here, the weird specificity of it makes it work, because I think the Night Gaunt is an absolute classic of a monster. First, it has great visual design. It just walks the line between the familiar and the uncanny. It has a resemblance to a traditional monster with the horns and the bat wings and the pointy tail, but the slick black sort of hide of it gives it enough of a twist on the design that it doesn't necessarily seem comfortingly familiar, right? When you see the little red devil with his pitchfork and his goatee beard and his little horns, if you actually saw that person appear in a cloud of brimstone, you'd be horrified. But in a game, there's something sort of comforting about him. You know where you stand with old Scratch. But these guys take that familiar image and they keep what's frightening about it, but then they change it up to make it strange and unfamiliar. Second, they've got a heck of a great name, Night Gaunt. It sounds good. It sounds bad, right? We know that knights are bad. Look at people who are gaunt and we think they're unhealthy. The idea of them being kind of skinny and angular, sort of like the Slender Man, I think that's a good creepy image. It ties in with the idea that they're flying monsters, a sort of lightweight quality. It sounds like what they are, but it doesn't necessarily mean anything specific. Very good. And the tickling people adds an element of weirdness. I mean, again, I think this is the trickiest part of the Night Gaunt cell, but potentially the most rewarding because it's not something you would have made up. If you sat down with a, you know, paper and pencil to create a horrific monster to dwell in the dream world that your characters were going to, whatever other plane they were visiting, you'd go through a lot of different monster special attacks before you ended up with tickling. And that's what makes it work. Because it's so weird that it doesn't, because it doesn't have a sense of narrative fitness, it has a sense of uncanny horror, even though it's otherwise ridiculous. I think the solution is to take images from your own dreams and monstrify them. I'm not necessarily saying that you're going to have the same kind of vivid dreams that Lovecraft claimed, in any event, to be able to recall dreams in detail that I certainly can't recall my dreams. But, you know, maybe we just have the creative work of a fiction writer turning the kind of vague impressions that I think are most people's dream memories into detailed narratives. But I think you can take images that come from dreams and turn them into monsters that have that same sort of frightening imagery, because it'll have that same quality of not necessarily making logical sense. So think if you want to have a monster that has the, you know, the horrific qualities of a Gug or a Moon Beast or a Night Gaunt, you want to start with those things that don't make sense. You want to start with images from dream. Or I say from dream because I said from your dreams, but it doesn't have to be from your dreams. It can be from anybody's dreams. There are lots of works of art that are based on somebody's dream. And, you know, again, not to like set this up as a standard of criticism, but I do think that there are ones where you can look at the image and see something that is more conventional, and there are others where you can look at the image and see something that's got a bit more of the raw, not making sense quality that a dream can have. And I think if you just, you know, find some of those and draw on them for imagery, you can help produce monsters that have the same kind of specific qualities that the Night Gaunts have that makes them such an effective Dreamlands creature. I am planning a new campaign that takes place against a kind of, not necessarily a gothic horror, folk horror, but definitely like that has characters from a more conventionally high fantasy background coming into what is understood as the bad place, the dark place in their world's map. And I think I'm definitely going to have Night Gaunts in there, in particular because I have players who are Lovecraft literate and will know what that means, but also because I think they're horror monsters in their presentation, but at the same time, Lovecraft uses them in this story as fantasy monsters. Like, they form up into a big army and have a battle with some other monsters. It's very Warhammer-y. So yeah, Night Gaunts. I think all of these really showcase the strengths of Lovecraft as a monster designer. I'm not saying that every Lovecraft monster is a winner, but when he succeeds, it's because of that combination of a genuinely creepy and uncomfortable visual description, a history that helps put the monster into its context, often a good name, and, you know, not just the history, actually, but the reactions of characters and of other monsters to it that help contextualize the thing. Like, look at the buildup to the Shoggoth in At the Mountains of Madness, or the progressive humanization of the old ones in At the Mountains of Madness that then allows Lovecraft to present this monster as a victim. Obviously, Lovecraft's writing style, I want to say it's of its era, but that's not quite right. It has idiosyncratic elements, certainly. It's partly of its era and partly like affectedly old-timey and partly just uniquely Lovecraft's voice. But, you know, while a lot of people, I think, maybe struggle with that in terms of enjoying reading Lovecraft stories, I think if you look at the way he creates and deploys monsters, it really is something that you can learn a lot from because he's jolly good at it. All right, that is about all the time that we have to talk about the monsters of H.P. Lovecraft's Dreamlands. Scott, I hope that you enjoyed the episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Scott, remember that all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. Or if you'd prefer to pledge at a lower level, you can do that instead. If you'd like to support the show, but you don't want to support it financially, and believe me, I understand, you can tell a friend about it. Word of mouth is probably the major way that I get new listeners, and people get to experience the hundreds of episodes of Monster Man that are just sitting there on the feed for anyone to enjoy. Alternatively, you could leave a rating or review on the podcasting app of your choice. That'd be great too. In our next episode, we are coming back to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.